south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander.
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started.
Let's start with an interesting boots-on-the-ground story. At least it was interesting for me. Recently, I was stuck in a layover situation at the Panama airport. The main one, the big one, Tucumán. I ended up sitting next to this guy, the same guy, for around 2.5 hours, so obviously we started talking. It turns out he wasn't hanging out on a layover. He'd missed his flight. He was a local guy, a Panamanian, who'd missed his flight because of some big traffic accident. He said there was a huge bottleneck on one of the major highways, and he got stuck right in the middle of it. Seems a big container truck lost control and flipped when a motorcycle made a crazy move and got caught under his wheels. Naturally, the guy sitting next to me was more than pissed off, missing his flight, and he had to wait 8 more hours to get another one. He was on his way to Madrid. So what do you think we mostly talked about? How about those crazy-ass motorcycles, the cucarachas of the road? Everyone who's got a car here in Latin America suffers for that. Anyway, so we're sitting there talking. Then we started telling our own personal stories. I told him that I'd hit 2 motorcycles, wiped them out completely. I told him how in the first instance, one motorcyclist cut across 3 lanes of traffic at once, and I whacked him. My second crash was with a motorcyclist who was going the wrong way down a one-way street. Then that guy told me he'd nailed 2 motorcyclists, too. One was a guy who ran a red light, and another one who ran a 4-way stop sign. Then I asked the million-dollar question, did you stop, or did you keep on going? Because, you know, if you ask a Latin lawyer, he'll tell you to stop, but unofficially, he'll say, with a nod and a wink, because of the legalities of the situation and the fact that the motorcyclist will almost always end up in the hospital, you'd be a lot better off to just keep on going. In other words, do what I say, not what I do. Or is it do what I do, not what I say? Anyway, I asked the guy, did you stop or did you keep on going? He said, I stopped because I'm an emergency room trauma physician. I said, is that right? Well, then you must have lots of mixed feelings about these motorcycle cucarachas. He said, that's an understatement. I see those guys every day and in the worst condition, too. In fact, on some weekends, half of my emergency room is filled with motorcycle trauma victims and their injuries are almost never good. Then I said, there's got to be a way to get these fools off the road or somehow get them to obey the rules. Too bad they just can be outright banned completely. That's what I said to him. I was a bit surprised when the guy shook his head and said, I'm not so sure about that. It's complicated. I said, what do you mean? He said, think about the secondary effects of banning them. Have you considered they're a driving force behind the lower and middle classes? They're sort of an engine for that part of the economy, he said, much like in the old days what a horse was for a cowboy. I said, you got that right. Those guys are cowboys. Now, what the trauma doc said next, I'd never thought about before. He said, did you know in developing countries, more than half of all the organs for transplant come from motorcycle accident victims. At least that's true of the chain of hospitals I work at, he said. I said, really, that's very interesting. And maybe in Latin America, that's 100% true. But have you heard of what they're doing to the Urdu population in China? The default organ donors over there? He didn't know what I was talking about, so I had to explain it to him. Funny how even professional guys with doctorates down here in Latin America often have very superficial knowledge about what's happening in the rest of the world. They're very good at their particular specialty, but have a sort of tunnel vision in regards to anything that's outside their sphere. Sound familiar? Anyway, then I said, think of all the positive things that would happen, though, if there were no more parasitic motorcyclists on the road. Or at least we could somehow get them to obey all the transit rules. They'd still swarm like cucarachas, but we, us car drivers, wouldn't have to be on the defensive all the time. Besides that, your emergency rooms, like you said, would be half full. Nicer, less hectic, less chaotic places, for sure. What's not to like about that? Then he smiled and said, yeah, but then I might just be out of a job. Oh, and he also confirmed the fact that almost no motorcyclists who come through the emergency room have any kind of insurance at all. Neither private health insurance nor vehicle insurance. Even though motorcycle insurance is mandatory in almost every single Latin American country. It just doesn't matter to the cucarachas of the road. even though, get this, full coverage motorcycle insurance costs around $4 a month. So I asked him about those motorcycle fools coming through the emergency room without insurance. I said, what do you do with them? He said, we have to treat them. Hippocratic oath and all that. By the way, we also got into a discussion about how we're seeing more and more motorcycles that are electric. Sort of a bright spot on the horizon anyway. They're coming, all right, slowly but surely, and it's a blessing, really. Two big advantages, you know, they're completely silent, and they put out no clouds or puffs of smoke. Now, if only Latin American countries were smart enough to put an import limit, or a deadline limit, by a certain year, no more gas-powered motorcycles. Wouldn't that be a treat? All countries will eventually do that, you know, but we've got this persistent chronic disease called mañana time. In fact, many Latin American countries now are switching over to completely electric public transportation. Now, I know it's hard to imagine an electric chicken bus, but it's in the works and it will happen. Time will tell. Oh, and one more thing, an important thing about vehicle electrification here in Latin America. Another good point the doc brought up in our long discussion waiting for flights at the Panama airport. He said, I'll bet anything, stealing electric power and hacking power poles will be the new national sport once the switchover comes to electric motorcycles. Just remember, he said, upper middle class and wealthy folks don't have motorcycles. It's the middle and lower classes that own 99% of them. The people making minimum wage, living from day to day. Believe me, he said, there'll be gray and black market and midnight electrical charging stations popping up all over the place. You watch. So we've got that to look forward to. An unintended secondary effect. All right, yanking the wheel a bit. As if you need another reason to have a plan B and get the hell out of Dodge. I'm looking at this article. Just came out today from the perennially woke and disgusting Los Angeles Times. A national paper that's only second best as a kitty litter liner / dog poop blotter to the New York Times. You know the New York Times, don't you? It's New York's communist, left-wing, LGBT, WTF, woke, fake news, newspaper rag of record. And that's just the sports section. Anyway, in the LA Times, the headline says there will be patrols and fines as Southern California water restrictions start rolling out. It says, as the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California announced its harshest ever water restrictions for millions of residents, the rules will kick in on June 1st, 2022, less than a month away. It goes on to say, the goal of the state water district is to try to shrink usage to about 80 gallons of water per person per day. Right now, it says the average Californian uses 170 gallons per day, with the three worst districts in California on average. Their residential customers use approximately 227 gallons of water per day, with the average around 125 gallons per person per day in the rest of the United States. Isn't it odd that in Latin America, the average water use per person per day is 25 gallons, about a quarter of the average per person daily use up in the States. The article says one of the major problems for such high usage, that's for people in California anyway. People love lush lawns and gardens, and some people like to leave their sprinklers on all night. Turns out in most of the rest of the United States, there's much less water usage because during the wintertime, no one waters their lawn. In California, it's all year round. So the average daily usage per person in California is almost double the national average. So how does that compare with Latin America? I think you know. From what I can see, down here in Latin America anyway, only wealthy people have sprinklers on their lawns, and the ones that do rarely leave them on all night, even though there is no winter freeze and the grass and gardens grow all year round. Still, people just don't squander water. The people don't, but Latin governments sure do. We'll get to that in a second. So you wonder, how are they going to roll out that plan in California? Well, first they're going to divvy up watering days among even an odd number of addresses. Then they'll be sending patrols through the area to take photos and videos and knock on doors, making sure people are complying. Those patrols will be looking for sprinkler use and waste, such as, get this, water that's flowing into gutters. Obviously, in California, it must be illegal for you to use water that ends up in your gutter. It says residents who are not complying will be given door tag warnings for the first offense and then be monitored heavily after that, with penalties and fines escalating greatly from there. It says homes that are not in compliance will have water restriction valves and devices installed. Yes, the change will likely be sobering for many millions of people, it says. You think? So, there you have it. Reason 4,456, why it's time to get that plan B in high gear and get the hell out of Dodge. Or at least have one foot planted in your favorite Latin American country. because everyone needs an escape hatch. And if you don't believe that, then why in the hell are you listening to this show? Now, about the water situation here in Latin America. Now, you may have read here and there that there are droughts. Yep, of course there are droughts. There are always droughts everywhere in the world. There's plenty of droughts here in Latin America, too. It's nothing new. You can go back in the archives of all the national periodicals and newspapers, and you'll see photos of crop failures and baked soil as well as floods in the rainy season, going back hundreds of years. Droughts and floods. It's part of living here in Latin America. Now, you have to be down here to see it from yourself, but when you go to one of these big fruit and vegetable markets, they just have an amazing assortment and quantity of food. The question is then, if you're reading about droughts all the time, how come the markets are so jam-packed with food that inevitably there's lots of spoilage? I don't get it. Somehow the propaganda doesn't fit the reality. And the floods? Yeah. Latin American farmers have been dealing with those for hundreds of years too. When the rainy season comes in that last 6 months, there's so much water. If you collected just a tenth of what hits your roof during that rainy season and could store it in your own big cistern, which I highly recommend, you'd never have to hook up to a municipal water supply or even have your own private well. Oh, and as far as having private wells here in Latin America, if you live out in the boonies, you're going to want one. Then, of course, you'll never run out of water. You can collect your own rainwater, too, and store it in a cistern if you like. And you're doubly prepared. You'll never be without water. By the way, if you've got your own private well, it's called a pozo down here, pozo. The only way it won't produce water is if the electricity goes out, because the pump is electric. By the way, all the big high-end subdivisions, gated, guarded communities, and residential towers have their own wells, so they don't count on municipal water for anything. They're not even hooked up to it, which is why they have water 24/7. And the big piece of misinformation, I hear this all the time, is when gringos and expats visit a Latino's house, they ask him about that big plastic cistern that's usually on the roof, and they say, what's that for? Well, the owner says that's because he only got water 10 or 12 hours a day, and that tank up on the roof collects water at night so that in the morning, when the water cuts out or just starts to trickle, the pump for the cistern kicks in, and we've got water all the time, even when there's no pressure in the municipal lines. And you know what? When gringos and expats first hear that, it scares them. Why wouldn't it? Up in the States, we've got water coming at us 24/7 out of the municipal pipes. Why would I want to live in a place where you only get water for half the day? And you've got to buy one of these crazy cisterns and pumps so you're not inconvenienced. Gringos are also thinking, what happens if it's only on 4 hours a day? Well, as I've said before, people who've got cisterns on the roof, they're on a municipal water supply. They're counting on city water, which you really can't count on because it's run by the government. What else is new? Not to mention, every city water worker will tell you that at least half of the water supply coming out of the mains is lost underground due to old pipe leaks, cracks, and bad joints. In fact, on any given day of the week, you could drive through a medium or large Latin city and see a spot where water's just coming out of a manhole cover. You'll see the occasional dirt patches and city lots that are saturated with water as well. If you walk on that land, it's spongy because an underground tube's been leaking for so long. Sometimes those leaks remain unrepaired for weeks, even months at a time. Then again, that's what you get when lard-ass government slugs, are there any other kind, are put in charge of the utilities. All right, now let's talk about planting a second flag, getting a second nationality, a second citizenship with a passport. That should be an end goal for everyone out there who's got a plan B. Gives you a lot more flexibility in the world. For example, if the shit hits the fan in your country, the U.S. or Canada, and the government starts restricting travel and movement, you know, they've had a lot of practice with that COVIDiot crap. That's when a second passport could come in really handy, could even be a lifesaver. By the way, that U.S. passport, man, it's not as good as you think it is. For example, you could be stuck in a situation like my friend Jeffrey was. Very tense, but he did play it cool. He was in Karachi, Pakistan, the largest city and capital of the country, on a business trip. He's a clothing manufacturer. He was out in the boonies on a weekend just taking pictures of the local sites and some ancient ruins. Oh, and he was all alone, too. Suddenly, a jeep pulled up. Four guys with guns wearing turbans jumped out. One guy pointed his AK-47 at Jeffrey and said, "You, American?" And he said, "Nope, Canadian." And he pulled out his Canadian passport. You see, Jeffrey was a dual citizen, U.S. and Canada, and had both passports on him. Luckily, he was quick thinking in the moment and pulled out his Canadian one. They looked at it, said, okay, and took off. Now, admittedly, that's sort of an extreme case, but things like that do happen. Remember, if there's ever a hijacking of a boat or a plane and you're on board, Who do you think's going overboard or out the window? The guy with the U.S. passport or the Israeli passport? Not the guy from Mexico, Guatemala, or Peru. Since our theme has always been Latin America, the question is, which Latin American countries recognize dual citizenship and what are the restrictions, if any? Because, you know, there are some countries in the world, a few in Latin America too, who do not allow you to have dual citizenship. You have to renounce one to get the other. All right, let's talk about some countries that do allow it, starting with Mexico. If you've been a legal resident in Mexico for more than 5 years, you're eligible to apply for a Mexican nationality and passport. Though to do so, you must also prove you have a good understanding of Spanish and the Mexican culture and take a test submitted by the SRE, the Secretaría de Relaciones Exteriores. By the way, if you fail that test, you can wait 10 days to take it again. If you fail again, you have to wait a whole year, but you can take it again. Though, being that this is Latin America, there are ways to bone up or hack that test through intermediaries, if you know what I mean. In other words, ways to grease the skids. Anyway, for Mexican residency right now, permanent residency that is, you must show that you have saved a minimum of $27,000 in the past year or that you get a regular monthly income from outside of Mexico of at least $620 a month. And if you're applying for permanent residency based on your ownership of real estate in Mexico, you have to prove that it's worth at least $216,000. So then what does a Mexican passport get you as far as travel? Well, it won't get you travel to the U.S. or Canada, but you can go to places restricted by your U.S. passport, like Cuba. By the way, if you're the traveling sort of person, I do recommend you hit Cuba at least once in your life. And don't do just the tourist spots in Havana and Varadero. That's the beach district. Get out to the boonies, the small towns. Talk to the people. That is, if you can get the people to talk, because freedom of speech, that is, freedom of speech to criticize your government, is prohibited. They'll punish you for it. Now, if you do get them to talk openly, you'll find out soon enough why socialism is a terrible system. Funny thing, too, a lot of people up in the States who've never been to Cuba say the reason why Cuba is so poor and undeveloped is because of the gringo sanctions that have been going on since the early 60s. If that's true, then Cubans should have a natural inbred dislike or even hatred for gringos, wouldn't they? If, that is, they believe the propaganda coming both out of the U.S. and Cuba. Well, surprise, surprise, you visit Cuba and you'll find they just love gringos there. Seems like everyone's got a Cuban relative, cousin, aunt, uncle, whatever, up in the States, sending back 100 or 2 a month, remises. In fact, I've never met a single Cuban who didn't want to live in the States. But I digress. Anyway, if you get Mexican citizenship, a Mexican passport, guess what? Your kids can study in Mexican public schools, and you'll be eligible to enroll in Mexico's medieval national healthcare system. Hooray! All right, let's talk about Colombia. After you've had residency in Colombia for 5 years, you can apply for Colombian nationality and passport. That's cut down to 2 years if you're married to a Colombian. That residency thing leading to passport is a little bit different in Colombia. You have to get your temporary residency first, which costs around $650. There are no other monthly income requirements. And you hold that for 5 years, and it switches automatically to permanent residency, which you hold for 5 years. Then you can go for nationality and passport. It takes about 10 years. Now, to go directly to permanent residency, and then it's only 5 years to nationality and passport, you can do that by investing about $165,000 in an approved real estate deal. Then you go immediately to permanent residency, and 5 years after that, you can apply for nationality and passport. That's Colombia. As for Panama, you can get citizenship after 5 years as a Panama resident too. But no, to get that residency, one way is by opening up a Panama company that actually does business. So you'll have to have a real legit business, not just an SA or LLC company. It has to have employees and file taxes. The big problem with getting a Panama visa, you see, is they got rid of, on August 5th, 2021, almost a year ago now, the fast-track version of the Friendly Nations visa. Now it's mighty tough. It ain't fast track no more. To get that visa, you have to get employment at a Panamanian company. Could be your own company, but you have to have an actual job in Panama. Or purchase real estate worth at least $200,000. Or deposit $200,000 in a 3-year CD earning 3.5% interest at a Panama bank. So, in effect, the new Friendly Nations visa rules are not so friendly at all. Besides that, even if you get that visa, you get a temporary one for 2 years, and then it switches to permanent. And you'll have to have that for 5 years or a total of 7 before you can apply for nationality and passport. Now, as for Costa Rica, you can get a legal second passport there after becoming a legal permanent resident. But you're required to live in that country for a continuous 7 years to qualify for that passport. Pretty tough to do. Now, as for the Dominican Republic, it seems to be a lot easier than a lot of Latin American countries to get naturalization and passport. For example, to qualify, you have to be a legal resident in the country for only 2 years. Or, better yet, if you've been granted residency by investment, investing in real estate, whatever, and that's generally a minimum investment of $200,000, you only have to wait 6 months to apply for Dominican nationality and a passport. By the way, the DR's tax system is most attractive. No wealth tax, gift tax, inheritance tax, foreign income tax, or capital gains tax. So you only have to pay personal income tax if you reside there and make your money there. Oh, and by the way, as far as real estate, how about this? In the DR, you're exempt from property tax on the first $100,000 of a real estate purchase. It could be your home, business, whatever. All right, how about Peru? Peru, like the previously mentioned countries, also allows dual citizenship. Once you get permanent legal residency, you have to be in the country for 2 years, and then you can apply for the passport. To get residency, you have to prove a permanent outside monthly income of at least $1,000 a month. Or you could get an investment visa, but you have to fork out at least $150,000 on an approved, and I don't like that word approved, investment or real estate deal. It used to be only 30 grand, but they changed that rule just recently. But I'll tell you what I really don't like about Peru, and I've been there. All resident gringos and expats there have to pay income tax on any money they've earned worldwide, just like lemmings in the U.S. However, non-residents in Peru are only taxed on the income they earn there in Peru. Totally ass backwards, if you ask me. And there are currently two tax brackets in Peru, 15% for annual income up to around $13,000. And after that, it's 30% if you make over and above 13K. Worse yet, the VAT tax, which is basically like the state tax in the United States, is at 18%. Nope, for those reasons and a couple of more, I wouldn't want to live permanently in Peru. Nice place to visit. They've got Machu Picchu and all that, but I wouldn't want to live there. Now, Brazil also offers dual citizenship. With the minimum time required to have a residency and be able to apply, 5 years. To get your permanent residency in Brazil, you have to prove that you have an outside income of at least $1,700 a month. And be over 60. Problem is, it's very difficult to get residency if you're under 60, unless you're married to a Brazilian. You'll have to start a business, produce a business plan, and must show that you'll employ at least two Brazilians, and you'll have to invest at least $100,000 in that business. It can't be a house or real estate. Anyway, I heard from other gringos down there that it's very difficult to get that kind of visa. Besides that, Brazil is known for being one of the most difficult countries in the world to do business in. There's just so much bureaucracy, red tape, and under-the-counter payoffs. Gringos tell me down there almost no gringo expats open businesses legally. They've got online business, but they don't have to be registered. Seems everyone I know in business in Brazil wants to be off the grid or is off the grid. But they do allow for dual citizenship. But honestly, the only gringos I know in Brazil who have Brazilian passports are the ones that married Brazilians. Any other way, they say, is just too much red tape. So anyway, those are the major countries in Latin America that allow dual citizenship. In other words, you keep your U.S. passport too. So then what about the other Latin American countries, the ones not mentioned? Well, most of the other ones, the ones we're interested in anyway, appear not to allow dual citizenship, but they do so in a roundabout way. For example, take Guatemala. After 5 years of permanent residency, you can apply for a nationality and passport, but when you stand in front of the judge in the court and swear your oath to the country of Guatemala, in that oath, you must state that you renounce all other passports and nationalities you might have. But here's the catch. It's just in that oath. It's not binding. The fact is, you could go into a foreign court and swear all day long that you're renouncing or giving up your U.S. passport and citizenship, but it doesn't mean a thing. It's not binding. As you might know, it's a long, drawn-out process to renounce your U.S. citizenship. Plus, you have to pay an exit tax, and you'll have to go through a couple of interviews at the embassy. So the end game is, if you're in line to get a passport from another country and when you're in court and you pledge the oath to your new country, if you're forced to say because the oath demands it that you're giving up your previous passports and nationalities, it's just non-enforceable, non-binding rhetoric. You know, earlier we were talking about Mexico, right? Well, there's a huge housing bubble going on there, especially in the gringoized areas. And people living there are at odds as how and when it's going to pop. Now, of course, if you're living up in the States, you're reading stuff in the paper from so-called analysts that are highlighting the fact that homes in Mexico are much more affordable than in markets like the U.S., Canada, or the European Union, and that loans are fairly easy to come by now. Well, here's the truth. If you want to live how the locals live, you want to live in a barrio, sure. Houses, especially rentals, are cheap compared to the U.S. and the rest of the first world. That is, if you don't mind the sound and pollution of chicken buses and people hawking goods at the top of their lungs and roosters crowing at all hours, not to mention your water being cut off a couple hours a day. While it's true that several banks, even state-run organizations, are offering easy lines of credit for locals and sometimes for gringos and expats, the interest on those loans is extremely high. For example, the average interest rate starts at roughly 12.5%. That's the best preferred client rate you can get, and you'll need 20, even 30% down. Now, there's this agency called Infonavit, I-N-F-O-N-A-V-I-T. That's the government-run housing loan agency. And if you ever saw the place and what it takes to get a loan, you'd see there's mind-numbing bureaucracy. But Latinos, you know, are used to it. You know the old joke. When Latinos see a line forming, they automatically get in it, whether they need to or not. Here's the thing, though. If you talk to builders and developers in Mexico, they're particularly concentrating on high-end apartments and new mid- and high-range condo towers. There's no dough in low-income housing. And those projects aren't cheap by any standards. For example, in high-rise condos where gringo tourism is prevalent, it's not unusual to find prices ranging roughly from 6 million pesos or nearly 300,000 US dollars for a single bedroom unit to over 11 million pesos for a two-bedroom unit. That's over a half million bucks. Similarly, prices during the last 10 years in Mexico, real estate prices that is, have risen around 300%. Yep, even in the scruffy neighborhoods, the barrios. So then where is this all leading to? Well, let's put it this way. People just aren't scared enough for what's coming next, my friends. I'm talking about a worldwide blowout. Can't you see it coming? And finally, today, on a lighter note, here's an email from Cal. He says, Johnny, you may have coined the word gringo advantage, but here's my definition of it. I've been living in Guatemala now for 3 years. My Latina wife is beautiful, a head turner, intelligent, fun, hardworking, and motivated, and has this horrible taste in men. I'm a lottery winner. That's what the gringo advantage did for me. And to think it took 6 months of boots on the ground before I even realized I had it.
South of the border. You've been listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America. If you need some help with your own Plan B, we can schedule a one-on-one phone or Skype consult. Just send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And if you want to get on the waiting list for my next week-long Expat Insider Seminar in Central America, where you're guaranteed to get a 2 to 5 year head start on your Plan B, send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. Nos vemos.